is being purpose-driven sustainable? You know, that to me is a real question. Like, can you really commit to it and have it enduring?
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So this is admittedly a little bit of a different type of episode. Often we spend our time talking about new technologies and how they'll be transforming society. But today we're talking about corporate social responsibility and brand purpose and all those other good things. You know, doing good at work and feeling good about the company that you're building. What role will employees expect of their companies? What will consumers expect from brands that they transact with? To answer this question, I turn to Alain Sylvain and Frank Cooper. Alain, and I'm hoping I'm saying that well because I did not do that well at French, he's the founder and CEO of Sylvain Labs, a strategy and design consultancy that helps companies seize the reality and potential of their businesses, products, and brands. Frank Cooper is the Global Chief Marketing Officer of BlackRock. As Global CMO, he is responsible for shaping BlackRock's global brand marketing strategy for institutions and retail clients. The two of them teamed up for one of the most compelling panels at Collision 2019 discussing the future of brand purpose. By the way, this conversation was recorded right outside the conference center in Toronto, so you're definitely going to hear a little bit of background noise here and there. When we weren't able to get good audio on account of the wind, we did have to make a few edits, but hopefully those won't be too distracting. Also, we started recording after we had already begun a great discussion about whether or not words like corporate social responsibility and design thinking and brand purpose are being appropriated. So you'll be entering the conversation about 1 minute in. So let's jump right in. Sorry, you were saying.
No, I was wondering whether you think they taint the well, you know, yeah. by misappropriating those words and exploiting them in ways that actually confuse people, right? Because they're not living out what they're talking about.
I think so. I mean, design and one of these concepts that's been confused because business has seized upon it. Because Stanford and IDEO, they create design thinking, all these things happening. Like, what is design? No one really knows what design is. I think purpose is in danger of that same sort of thing. Yeah. You know, because Frank talks a lot about this. It's corporate purpose, it's brand purpose. There's a lot of different ways you can conceive it, but ultimately, there should be a shared definition around what we mean when we say purpose.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise, it's. I mean, in a weird way, it's kind of like the idea of artificial intelligence now, where everybody tries to appropriate the term and say, oh, my, you know, stock will rise as a startup by just saying, oh, we've got some AI, trust us. But
right.
But if you define it, if you put some parameters around doing good or CSR or, you know, ethical behavior and what it is and what it isn't, then you don't have other people encroaching on the term without actually doing it, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This whole notion, though, that this is something totally new and out of the blue and never existed before, I think is not correct. I think it's not a trend. I think it's reclaiming what's always been there. I mean, people go back to all the way back to Adam Smith, and everyone talks about the Wealth of Nations, right? But he wrote Theory of Moral Sentiments before that, and that was much more about ethics and virtue and relationships and how that plays culture, really, how that plays into economics. To me, this exploitation issue is true. And some companies are going to use it as a cloak. They say, like, hey, look at me, I'm purpose-driven. Some will use it as a shield to try to defend against attacks. But there's still an underlying truth to it all. And that truth is that I think more and more people want to have a sense that as employees, they're contributing to something larger. And it doesn't have to be so spectacularly large that it's about, I'm going to solve water scarcity in the world. It could be as simple as I'm giving you more time back through convenience, you know, or it could be that I'm providing a sense of community, or I'm actually giving you a sense of both individual and collective identity. You've been historically marginalized. I'm pulling you to the center stage. There's a bunch of ways to come at it, but the most important piece is that it's not purely CSR. It's your commercial operations are tied to that as an ultimate goal, and profits just happens to be one of the outcomes of it. That to me is that's the opportunity that I see kind of that lies before us.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the challenge, obviously, with it is that I think that most companies, you can't just do good without figuring out, like, how do I do good, but at the same time generate the profit that's expected for my shareholders or for my, you know, employers or investors, whatever. So how does a, you know, company balance those two things by saying, you know, or is it just a matter of saying, trusting that by doing good, the other things will follow, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what Frank ended on, I think, is really key, is that profit is one of the metrics at the end of the day. And when you broaden it, to include purpose, you know, are you committing to your purpose as an output? I think inevitably you're thinking about more than shareholder value. You're thinking about community, you're thinking about employees, you're thinking about customers, suppliers, vendors. You know, what we talked about on stage, what I talked about on stage was Ben and Jerry has this thing that they talk about called linear prosperity. Have you heard of this thing? It's pretty cool. It's basically they're committing to the idea that as the company does well, all their employees and customers, all that will do well. And I think that perspective is a new way of thinking about business. You're not thinking about shareholder value. You're not thinking about short term. You're thinking about the collective. And as the company grows, so too will the community beyond it. And I think that's the throwback to the inception of what the role of companies were meant to be as organizations, as institutions that were communal. The idea of shareholder value, I think, is relevant, but it's just one part of what the expectations should be, I think, for the company.
Yeah, and I think this whole bifurcation of doing well by doing good should go away. You know, I think now it should be just merge it together, and it's just doing well inherently is defined as you're serving some human need. Just merge it together, because the separation of the two, in a way, creates a kind of strange thing. The doing well piece, it's like make your profits and serve the world. I would say flip it, serve people. And in serving people, you figure out how you actually sustain the company. And sometimes that might not mean maximizing profit at every single turn. You know, when CVS said, I'm going to pull the cigarettes off the shelf, they weren't maximizing profits in the short term. Mm-hmm. But they pivoted toward this idea that we're a healthcare company in long term, that it actually will benefit us. They also want to merge it with Aetna. But the point was, they had a sense of, like, here's why we exist in the world, and that's going to be our ultimate goal. And we're going to keep that front and center. We've got our strategy. We've got our decisions. It'll be the North Star for our employees. And I think that's just, I don't know if we call it doing well by doing good. I think it's just doing what you do to serve people.
Yeah, I mean, the concepts, again, business has seized upon this in so many different ways.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. You got that on audio, right?
You heard it here first. I'll send you guys that. Yeah, like you didn't hear it enough times today.
But business is kind of, there's doing well by doing good, which is a trope that you hear a lot about, which is about, you're right, it trivializes the doing good part. CSR is a whole other way to think about it in the corporate sector. It's completely different. Like you said, you mentioned you're writing a piece about CSR, partly about CSR. That's completely different than the way you're defining purpose.
Yes.
And, you know, CSR is almost like it's almost like big companies showing contrition because of their impact on the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've worked for some of these groups in big companies, and it's pathetic. CSR budgets are pathetic relative to big
it's to say we did something and not necessarily to orient the company around that.
Right. Exactly. Right. It's really troublesome. I worked with a big beverage company one time, and they had, you know, their imprint, their environmental imprint on the world was horrific, but they created a little, like a little group, and they would, you know, distribute water at crises or something.
Yeah.
And that was CSR, and it was like wash their hands of their imprint. So I think what we're talking about, three definitions of how purpose, corporate purpose is, right? There's the CSR piece, which to me is about contrition. There's the do well by doing good piece, which is about compromise to different motivations at the same time. And then there's this thing that Frank's talking about, which I think is do well as a key priority, and everything else will fall into place, including profits.
Yeah.
Those are three different.
Yeah, no, you're right. Different strains of, and I think part of the reason why it's been almost like these different parallel discussions is because different people can be won over by different arguments, you know? So there are some people where you say doing well by doing good because that's the only way you can get them on board.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there are some people who do believe, you know what, we need to achieve a 30% profit, but we don't need 32. So let's figure out what we can do with that so we don't get above our levels and actually act as good citizens.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's right. I mean, you're exactly right. What I hope, though, is that more leaders, purpose-driven leaders, ask themselves one question. It's like, how do we serve people in this world in what we do? Like, if we were extraordinarily successful and we achieved every single goal that we put out, and what is the outcome of that on the world? And when you start to ask that question, then you start to reframe your ultimate goal. Your ultimate goal is much bigger than profits. It's much bigger than CSR. It's much bigger than doing well by doing good. Now, the reality, though, and kind of the cold water in the face, is quarterly earnings pressure, right? And that's a piece I don't have. We talked about this during our panel today. Don't have a direct answer for that, except it requires, I think, investors, academics, consumers all to kind of coalesce and say we actually value companies that have purpose at the center, and we're going to vote with our wallets. We're going to vote by investing differently. We're going to vote by buying things differently. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and it's also, it's one of those things where it's very easy, I think, for most people to say, okay, we have like quarterly earnings coming up. Can we cut one thing to then just this quarter to hit our numbers, to make our numbers look a little bit better? And then next quarter, it's like, I know we said we would just do it once, but then we do it twice. Yeah. And it's kind of like this whole, is there an inherent tension between short-term and long-term thinking?
Yeah.
That short-term will always win if that's how the average person is incentivized.
Yeah.
Whereas if someone's pay is tied towards the long-term performance of the company and not towards the short-term, could that be a way of, you know, incentivizing long-term behavior?
100%. We should take the pressure off of quarterly earnings reports so that people start to think more long-term. I hope that happens. But this is on both ends of the spectrum. You know, if you look at the soul of a startup early on, even though they state a purpose, they're really out to survive. And they do whatever it takes to survive. And they're like, this is one time we'll make a change. Same thing on the other end. You know, people who are large corporations, they're looking to survive and survive quarter by quarter because their tenure as a CEO depends on it. Somewhere in between there, there's like this, I won't call it nirvana, but there's almost this moment of equilibrium, you know, where the actual purpose is lived and believed and people fully engage in it. Just doesn't last very long because the ecosystem doesn't support it. You know, the structure is not there to support it long term.
Yeah, that's really, yeah. I mean, it's not just, is being purpose driven sustainable? I mean, that to me is a real question. Like, can you really commit to it and have it enduring? I'm really encouraged by what's happening at BlackRock. I'm not saying that because Frank's my client. Like, truthfully,
by coincidence.
Yeah, exactly.
No, truthfully, I mean. And I think that's why he took the job, by the way. Like, it happened even before he showed up at BlackRock. What Larry Fink's doing is pretty profound. And I think what we're getting at is a very different... When it's a founder-driven company, yeah. I think it's easier to do this.
Yeah.
So it's easy for Larry to put out letters to CEOs and say, think long-term. But when you're a public company and you inherited the job and you're being incentivized by a quarterly, I think this question is different.
The pressure for companies to become more purpose-driven... and to the extent that it's coming from ordinary people, it's coming from really what we see as what we're calling the populist movement, right? It's people saying, I feel left out of prosperity in this country. And that doesn't seem to be unique to any particular region right now. So you go to Germany, you see it. You go to Italy, the five-star movement, you see it. You go to Norway, you see it. You go to Sweden, they have it. You go to Brazil and Bolsonaro, you see it. You go to the United States, you see it. You go to Philippines and Duterte, you see it. They're all saying the same thing, which is, I see prosperity around me, I'm being left out. And by the way, when I look forward, I'm even more fearful.
One thing I was just curious about is the quantification of this, right? Because I think that this is something that, you know, folks like all three of us believe on some level is very important. And yet, the way that anything happens is, you know, through data and by showing people who might disagree with your point that they're incorrect. And I mean, just what kind of data is out there to show that this is the wave of the, not to say this is the first time ever that we've cared about this, but that this is something that's going to grow in the future in importance and not lessen.
I think, go ahead. No, I think that's the most important unlock for us right now. We're actually working on it. I mean, there's some signs of it. There's a lot of data of people showing that performance-driven companies outperform those who are not performance, purpose-driven companies outperform those who are not over a five-year period. If you look at the S&P 500, et cetera. You know, whether that's rigorous or not is a questionable. But what is pretty clear is that we know we have low employee engagement across the board, across every industry. Like 80% employees feel kind of unengaged in work. We know that if you can get employees to feel more engaged at work, their performance will be higher, productivity will be higher. But let me ask both of you guys the question then, because I'd love to hear both your answers to this. But are consumers willing to punish companies that actually don't live up to their purpose? You know, I can think of a few right off the top of my head that they don't seem to have received much punishment for violating their stated purpose. So Patagonia goes out, which this is hypothetical, and they go out, and we all know Patagonia's purpose, you know, to improve the environment overall. They go out and they support raising half of the rainforest, you know, in order to produce. Right. You know, housing for the populations that they serve and clothes, right, et cetera. And people find out, they're like, wait a minute, this is such a fundamental violation of who you are.
It's a hypocrisy.
Is it okay?
No.
There's two things to it. I think one thing is it's not okay. If a company does something that reeks of hypocrisy, then I think that just in general, when you do something that's off-brand, it's a bigger deal than if you just do something that isn't good.
Yeah,
you know, like being off-brand tends to really hurt you. But I think the other key thing is it provides an opportunity for somebody else to jump in. And for instance, Amazon is not known as being the most socially conscious company in the world, but there isn't a company out there that is a great substitute for Amazon. Therefore, they can't get punished. So it creates an opening for somebody else when you stumble, but it doesn't mean that people are willing to, they don't have somewhere else to go.
Right.
So what that says is, you know, you have to find somewhere else to go, and if there isn't anywhere, then, you know, we all kind of look the other way and pretend
that's definitely true with Uber, right? Like, delete Uber, because that's what you're thinking. Like, if it wasn't for Lyft, that delete Uber movement would not have happened.
I literally, since I sold my agency, and I've been doing journalism for a while, but since I sold my agency, had a little bit of extra time, so I started doing some stand-up comedy type of stuff. And I said, I was going to take a Lyft here, but I figured, you know, I'd take a Uber because I hate women, you know? and there's like an element to that where it's like we all kind of agreed, or a lot of people agreed, you know what, we're not happy with Uber's practices, so we'll look the other way because it was in some places just like the best thing to get around.
I know, and that's what I'm concerned about, because people, like, they point to Travis and all the activity and the culture of the company and say it's horrific. Then you're like, so damn convenient, and you felt like, even though we had the delete Uber movement, Lyft never really stepped into the void enough where you felt like, you know, I can get the same cars and service as Uber, and so Uber lives on.
When you become that ubiquitous, you know, then that's the, I mean, and I'll still try to take Vias around because it's actually is really good mapping technology, but I think that ultimately, I mean, not to be political, but to say, somebody else was describing this to me. It's like a lot of people they wouldn't agree necessarily with most things about Trump, but they voted for him because they knew that he was going to do this, this, and this, and that mattered enough to them that they were willing to look the other way about the individual that they were voting for.
Right. I mean, this is a, and by the way, getting political, you're in a safe space. Like, we would, I love talking about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
A big question I have is, how much, how complicit are we as consumers? You know, you mentioned Amazon and Uber, and I took an Uber here. How complicit am I in these companies violating their purpose or whatever. And I think about this a lot. You know, I'm, Instagram is a great platform. I connect with people on it. It's a great way to see what's going on. But I also am deeply concerned and troubled about Facebook and their and what they're doing, you know, around privacy. And they're trying to connect the world, but at what cost? And but every time I open up that app, I am furthering their cause.
Yeah.
And I think there's a big question around how much, how responsible are we? As you know, we were talking about voting with your dollar before and all that, but it's also voting with your behaviors. And I'm,
I
don't know. I have a lot to think about. I have a lot to say about that.
Isn't it just a matter of, and I'm curious what you think, but isn't it just a matter of the mechanics of these technologies are such that you know that if you don't use it, it doesn't actually matter? I mean, sure, if everybody, if you had enough of a, like if Kim Kardashian started a whole entire movement to delete Instagram and got her 100 most famous friends, then I think that you can make a that maybe that could kill Instagram, you know? But you alone don't have the ability to do so. So therefore, you say, if I can't, if you can't beat them, join them. It's kind of like the wisdom of the crowd or the idiocy of the crowd also in some situations. You know, if you look back at, you know, like any dictator in history that had the support of millions of people, none of those millions of people is being shamed because they were with a whole lot of other people.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
So as long as you stick together, you can't be that shamed by taking the wrong action.
Right.
And I think that in some ways that that's what happens in corporate society. If every other CEO acts that way, how can you really, you know, be faulted?
Well, I think that's deeply troubling. You know, it's a very troubling, I mean, that's, you know, Nazism and so on. It's like, you know, you kind of, you're like, nothing bad's going to happen. We'll just kind of hang. I mean, and the worst things can happen if there's like enough momentum behind them. I don't think it's enough to say like everyone else is doing it. I don't know. I think there should be an uprising. This is where I get political.
But we're not going to change the fundamentals of human nature. You know, you know, most of the people are going to follow the crowd. You know, going to follow, and so the question is, the opportunity is, how do we make the crowd follow things that have a positive impact on the world? You know, how do you develop it in a way where it's easier to adopt and you see the benefit of it in the short term? It's not like a like, hey, in 10 years from now you're going to feel really good. You know, no one's going for that right now. They want to help. And so I think if you look at it through a cultural lens, how do you make them feel it today? How do you make it more of a movement? That's our opportunity. And we're never going to, well, I don't think in our lifetime we're going to change human nature in that way.
Well, almost like by nature, like if the definition of it, if human nature is, it's a natural thing that basically maybe you can't change human nature. Maybe you can just say, accept this is human nature. How do we gamify it to our, to positive?
Exactly right. Exactly.
I mean, I found it interesting when you said culturally there's sort of a motivation to, how did you put it? You said kind of prioritize revenue over purpose in the United States. And I think looking at this from a cultural point of view is really interesting. Because is it natural to be driven to for convenience? Like, is this idea of, like, I'm not going to care about Amazon or Uber, is that human nature? Is convenience human nature? Or is have we been conditioned to really want convenience at all costs?
I mean, I get to watch my kids. I get to see what the consumers of tomorrow, how they'll think through that lens. So I say, like, that's why I had them, market research. You know, because of that, you're able to see what are things that are inherent to us versus what are maybe things that I just had as a kid being born, you know, born in the 70s. I mean, maybe there's certain things that you're just a product of your culture for the time you were born.
I think so.
Yeah.
How old are your kids, out of curiosity?
Oh, yeah. Let me see what time. 5.5, 2.5, and negative 2 months.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Last time I get out of New York, right, 3 years probably. But,
right, exactly.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Well, the price is high if you do. If you do leave it during that time.
Oh, right? God, yeah.
The cost,
well, the price is, especially with my wife left at home,
yeah,
I just know I'm making it up. I'm making it up in spades on this one.
I have 3 kids, too, and I see. Definitely see future consumption habits through their eyes. It's very interesting. Like, my son plays Fortnite like crazy. Not like crazy, but he plays it a lot. And it's funny how brands have inserted themselves in that video gaming environment. And it's interesting to see him favor those brands because they're in that environment. So I hear what you mean. Yeah.
I think another example of that, by the way, is privacy, you know, because you hear a lot of, I mean, I hear a lot of people who are very pro-privacy, privacy's great, you got to protect it and all that stuff. I don't see the younger people who I know, and I mean this, people young, older than my kids, they kind of grew up with the idea of less privacy inherent in their life than we did.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, they don't care about it as much because it's not this inherent thing that they assume that they own.
Look, I mean, I think that's the most alarming thing right now is the comfort level that particularly younger people have with the use of their data. Because if you believe that the machines will be smarter and smarter, at some point you have to question whether or not free will is being shaped by companies. You know, beyond what people think, they're like, hey, I think I'm buying this because I want it. But actually, they figured out exactly your trigger points. Right. And they figured out exactly when you would actually be most susceptible to buying it. There's a line in which I think it becomes very alarming. And so I think we have to train ourselves and educate people broadly about the dangers of giving up their data and how that might be used.
Yeah. That's true. Just because we're okay with something doesn't mean it doesn't actually have adverse effects, you know. That's cool.
Complicity. It goes back to your earlier point about if everybody does it,
yeah,
what's the big deal?
Yeah. And sorry for the abrupt ending there, but honestly, I didn't even think the audio was going to be good enough to use. It admittedly was maybe like a C+, but I feel like the conversation is such an important one for us to be having, and I think it's a little bit different from some of the things we've been running more recently, so be sure to let us know what you think, and while you're at it, rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever finer podcasts are sold. Until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.